everybody, and welcome to our final seminar. I want to spend, I'm going to leave open mic for any questions or discussion or additional things you want to comment on, but I want to respond to a couple of things that are related enough that I wanted to address that, and it's about basically how can you exit a negative thought loop, like a repetitive focus on problems, negative self-talk, self-blame, worries, fears, ruminations. A couple of things to think about. If you treat that thought, whatever it is, as if it's a reality or a fact, then you may engage it. And if you engage something, you've already validated it. So that's where I want to address how to think about that. There are three steps, and we touched on this, but I want to review it and reiterate it here. It's described as self-directed neuroplasticity. In other words, we can change our own brain by the way we address something as simple as this happening of a negative thought loop or recurring things that that you address. The first step, whatever it is, negative self-talk, self-blame, worry, fear, rumination, instead of treating it like a fact, treat it like an error message from your brain. Because what you experience is likely triggered in some way that creates a state change, that you enter that state of rumination, of negative self-talk. The content of that hasn't changed for a long, long time. It's always there. It's always the same. No matter what you do, it doesn't change it. So the idea is to not engage it, to not enter that state. So there are three steps. First, recognize it as an error message from your brain. Then, reframe it in a positive way. How can you adaptively deal with it? What's the challenge? What's the opportunity here? And then refocus on the next step. These three steps can occur within seconds. To recognize, reframe, and refocus. Recognize the error message from your brain, because there's an automatic trigger and an automatic response and the same kind of information, and focus. The content probably hasn't changed. Fears, worries, ruminations, self-blame, negative self-talk. So that's something to keep in mind in order to stay really focused and to get very present instead of engaging that altered state and being stuck in it. So any thoughts or questions about this? Is this making maybe simpler sense than when we talked about it the first time? Or any clarifications or questions about it? Each time you do this, rather than engaging something, which moves you into that state even further, just recognize the emotional trigger, pause, and respond with a balanced state. Recognize, reframe, refocus. Any additional thoughts or questions or things you want to be sure we address before I move into the material and put us on lecture mode? Okay, I'll reserve a bit of time at the end so that if you have questions or clarifications, please jot them down, and I'll get us back to a discussion mode. So we're going to talk about updating your operating system, about writing new stories, and how we can facilitate that with our clients. First, let's look at how our brain organizes a sense of self, because this is bedrock for our identity. Brain imaging studies have demonstrated where the sense of self resides in the brain, the medial prefrontal cortex. This part of the brain lights up when we self-reflect, when we make assessments and judgments regarding ourselves. So here are some self-reflection prompts. A principle. Whatever you think or feel or experience is what you create each moment. To say that a slightly different way, whatever you experience, you either create or agree to. So listen for the story that you are creating. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it. Plan it, map it, tell it, then initiate a systematic way of going about it. That's the essence of what we do in coaching, is to create with our client a system. Every coaching engagement, every coaching conversation is a story, a beginning, middle, and end, a challenge, a development, a resolution. And that's what we bring to help our clients internalize that process to ultimately not need us. So whatever you're experiencing in any way is in response to the story you're creating. So that awareness and self-reflection is a beginning, because that keeps the point of reference internal. So whenever I reworded the whatever you experience, you either create or agree to, creating is an internal point of reference. Agree to means you move the point of reference to someone else. You're either fitting into or opposing. Now, this new storytelling has to align with who you are, especially your needs and your ideals, so that whatever the strategy and the goals are, it fits with fundamental needs and ideals. And that makes a really important synthesis of creating new goals and new recognitions. So when you practice your authentic story, it activates full energy and power. All of you is going in the same direction. Needs, ideal, strategy, and goals. So this is why I think it's important to know for each client their needs and their ideals, and to have for each session as well as the coaching engagement where they want to get to, the goals that they have in mind, so that you're both proceeding in a systematic way. Let's look for just a moment at pre-commitment. I want to tell you a story I know you guys have heard about. In the Odyssey, Odysseus and his men were sailing home from the Trojan War. He'd been warned about the sirens, whose seductive song leads sailors to destruction, but he wants to hear it anyway. So he does two things. He gives his men earplugs and gives them orders that they tie him to the mast and ignore any pleas he has for release until they're safely past that danger. Now, this management of desire invents pre-commitment to inoculate against predictable and potentially fatal future desire. Willpower alone in the moment might not have been sufficient, and Odysseus knew that no one is immune to certain kinds of overwhelming temptation. Pre-commitment can be especially useful when it comes to bad habits or obvious weaknesses, and it involves present planning and action against the strength of future desires, either by taking certain options off the table or making them prohibitively costly. Pre-commitment works and enables anyone to control their actions or face their own chosen penalties. Commitment devices. Now, as we think about being an accountability partner in coaching, commitment devices may be a consideration. There have been studies on how people self-impose as well as co-create commitments for behaviors that they know are in their best interest. This is in addition to having a systematic approach. For example, ways that people counter their own vulnerability and bolster commitment. Some alcoholics take Antabuse, a pill that makes you sick when you drink. In one study, college students were given the option to create their own earlier deadlines for 3 papers due by the end of the semester. 75% of them jumped at the chance. Now, what's striking here? 100% of them always have the option of creating their own deadlines. It just had to come externally because of that context. It's always an option to set your own goals. People find ways of saving themselves from immediate cravings. Harvard Business School looked at ways people dealt with purchasing things they wanted versus things they should have or needed. They would devise ways to put off purchasing or having delivered the want products to ensure that they would do the should or the need ones first. And here's a goofy one. This has actually been done, freezing a credit card in ice to mandate a contemplative pause before purchase. And think about how automatic retirement fund deposits from a checking account can make commitment a one-time decision. So this is a sense of engineering effectiveness. And this is the thought loop that I mentioned at the very beginning of looking at ways to self-direct our own changes. So this is a review, basically, of recognizing that it's not there until you create it. You have a negative thought loop. You have fears, worries, rumination, negative self-talk, negative and self-blame. The self-directed neuroplasticity, simply to recognize the error message of that repetitive indication, usually triggered by some kind of immediate anxiety or basically change even, can immediately set that in motion. And those 3 steps can be a way to increasingly direct that to rewire. So Mark Twain said, "I've lived a long life and I've had many troubles. Some of them even actually happened." So let's review some essentials now of engineering effective change, ways that we can be a catalyst with our clients. 1, focus specifically on the next step. Terry Fox started the Marathon of Hope. It's a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed, though, to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. When he completed the race, he was immediately interviewed and asked, how did he keep going when he was exhausted and challenged and knew that he had thousands of miles ahead? He said, "I just kept running to the next telephone pole." He shrank the change to a simple next step. 2, specify the next step. And this is for us when we're listening to what our clients commit to. Not abstract, not global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. That's why SMART goals have T on the end for time bound. Acting healthier is not a strategy. 3. Make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are and where you're going, the two coordinates of a map, to measure progress along the way and also to tell what's detour and distraction. Now, some of this is just such a basic review, but I thought it might be interesting to reflect back after we looked at so many different variations of the mind and brain sciences. 4, make progress measurable. Demystify the journey, a specific destination, a tangible focus on the next step. And 5, make progress. This is in your outline. Make progress visible, small, specific, attainable milestones that are actually visible and celebration of each small victory. And again, the best example of shrinking a task to a tangible next step or next item is Alcoholics Anonymous. Challenge members to one day at a time. And if they're really pressed, they will add sometimes it's 1 minute at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. And to say that very simply, all you ever have to do in life is the next best thing. This shrinks the change to an immediate step of effectiveness, but along with it, the experience of momentum. So what we've done in a simple summary, we've adopted the scientific method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. The scientific method is a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry generates discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. So here are some considerations when we look at choice enhancement and how emotion and choice interact. Increased tension produces, at times, emotional regression. With increased tension or a specific conflict, a stress response action, reaction, can move someone into an emotional pattern that's more characteristic of an earlier age. An example, I've got to be doing something wrong. All the things I know to do aren't working. Or to instantly move into that negative self-talk or the things that we discussed at the very beginning of this seminar, those automatic script responses. 2, increased emotion narrows perspective. When we are a bit away from being grounded and centered, focus becomes narrower and more restricted to the most recent event. And when someone is in that state, when a client then is in a state that is more emotional, attempting to use reason and logic when someone's escalated in an emotional state only makes it worse. It deepens that automatic pattern. The escalated individual will further escalate, dig in their toes, and sometimes spiral into more extreme responses and move away from logic. Now, when you're in a state of upset, the first order of business is to regulate feelings. At times, the most important thing to do is nothing. Think about how when there's a challenge or what would otherwise be a state change, to simply pause and then respond from a balanced state. This is significantly challenging, but significantly beneficial. Having a way, as we've discussed before, to instantly get grounded and centered can be the first step to really then focus on a response from that balanced state. Learn the optimum state of mind for different tasks. Protect your time for an endeavor of a particular state of mind. Anxiety, for example, is an energy experience. The most effective antidote to anxiety is grounding yourself, transforming that energy by becoming focused and present. Tension regulation, de-escalation tools become essential to foster listening and communication. The use of empathic listening and communication of understanding with our client often is a first and central de-escalation tool for regulating emotion and restoring reason. A client begins with, I just feel so overwhelmed. We're tempted to get into the content and create strategies rather than the first engagement may simply be, I hear how overwhelmed you are. That's a first step to engage someone to then move together in a way to create a different story. Now, let's look for a minute at choice architecture. An example of choice architecture is a study at a local car wash that ran a promotion featuring loyalty cards. Each time a customer bought a car wash, they got a stamp on their card. And when they filled their card with 8 stamps, they got a free wash. Now, another set of customers, same car wash, got a loyalty card in which they needed to collect 10 stamps to get a free car wash rather than 8. But they were given a head start in that when they received their cards, 2 stamps had already been added. The goal was the same for both sets of customers, requiring the purchase of 8 car washes to get a reward. But the psychology affected the motivation. For those who had a head start with 2 stamps, already 20% of the way to the goal, the results were that 19% of the 8 stamp customers earned a free car wash, and 34% of the Head Start group earned a free car wash, and they earned their free car wash faster, meaning they were able to start over and spend more money sooner. So what this means in terms of our clients, people are motivated to be partly finished with a longer task or journey than to be just beginning an even shorter one. So what this means in a practical way is to help our client frame the task so that they see stepwise progress and can validate their own progress and also feel that they are getting closer and closer to the finish line. This, whether it should or not, this enhances motivation. So this is part of our empathic resonance with the client too, to celebrate a positive step, to be able to pause and self-reflect about where they were, where they are now, in terms of where they're going, to be able to see progress in different perspectives and with different lenses. So how you frame something can change the meaning. The meaning can change your mind. Your mind can change your brain. Meaning derives from the frame we place around an event or situation. And the structure of meaning is an inside job. Now, we talked about this in the very beginning. If we frame something in a particular way, it will affect how we engage it and the mindset we use. If we experience, and remember I talked about the example, our brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. It's the same stimulation, same area, same degree. If we frame it as anxiety, that boots up a very different mindset of caution, maybe of avoidance. If we frame it as excitement, as challenge, as opportunity, that boots up a very different mindset so that we look at possibilities, and that creates, in that framework, the whole mindset of creating new neuronal pathways and networks. And obviously, this is what we do with our clients that can be of significant help. So how you frame a question even can make a bit of difference. Here's an example. When companies automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings plans, the employee has to opt out to not participate. In other words, to make a choice that says, I will not save for my future. When it's automatic, in other words, it's 100% initially by definition, then it levels to between 86 to 94%. Where it isn't automatic and somebody has to choose to opt in, 20% participate, over a four-fold difference. So here's another example of that. Another example of how we're sensitive to things that shouldn't matter, but it's good to know what does matter and how framing can be important, especially for our work with clients. One group of countries in Europe has an option that people can donate their organs unless they check a box that says they don't want to. They have to actively opt out. The rate of organ donation, when it's automatic, 95%. Another group of countries have a form where if someone does donate their organs, unless they check the box to donate, they have to opt in other words. They have to make a decision to opt in. The rate of donation, 18%. Again, over a four-fold difference just in how we frame something. So, as we discern meaning, we know that we need a context to surround it. The frame can even determine a state of mind. We help clients reframe. Someone has a setback, a disappointment, or a crisis. Rather than continuing to focus on the upset or the negative energy or the strategy, we reframe by asking the question, what's the opportunity here? Problem to possibility. Possibility framework. When someone completes their list of options or run out of possibilities, we nudge. What else? The reticular activating system at the base of the brain decides what's allowed into consciousness out of all the information streaming into the brain. For example, right now, pay attention to your feet. Wiggle your toes, move your feet in your shoes, notice the sensation. Now, that sensation has always been there. You just selectively paid attention to it. We pay attention. We selectively focus on whatever fits our story, the framework we use. For example, part of your story is your self-image. If somebody says something really nice about you and you don't believe it, it won't register, or it'll be disavowed with, well, what are they trying to sell me? So we help our clients look at the process of how to frame something. Natural filters that we're listening for include beliefs, self-image, goals. So new behavior and new experiences create new pathways in the brain. With each repetition, these pathways become a bit more etched each time. When they're well-grooved, it becomes a habit and automatic behavior, the default mode. Your future self resides in your present mind. If it's clearly visualized, it's a matter of actualizing that vision. At the back of your outline, there's a reprint of a brief chapter from a book of mine called Outsmart Your Brain about a systematic way to look at creating a vision and affirmations to support that vision. It's kind of the neuroscience applied to visualization and affirmation. I think you'll find it useful. And I did it so we wouldn't have to really go over it here. Another is focus. Where you have direct impact, what you can determine, where you can be effective, is your circle of influence. Whenever somebody cuts you off on the freeway, getting angry is a natural response. But it won't help. It won't undo it. It won't inoculate for the next occurrence. This is your circle of concern. Things like population and housing prices, how your partner responds, that is of concern, but over which you are not immediately effective. So this is something we may want to think about as we're listening to a client when they're describing something. Are they describing something that they have determination over? Or, no matter what they do, or how good they are, or how influential they are, they will never be able to bring that about or create that event. So this is a very basic way of listening for a client who may not have thought about it in that way and still engages as if they should be able to determine how someone else responds. This is the essence, the dynamic, I think, of anger. What is anger? Well, it's the reaction to the recognition of the fiction of our omnipotence. In other words, to our helplessness. When you hear someone being angry at something, often it's their assumption that's not working. So that's where we can be effective in coaching. This is where we have to be truly empathic with someone and be absolutely certain that in no way are we heard as judgmental or critical or pejorative, but we may need to collaboratively look with that client at, is this something that they can determine, or is this an assumption that won't work? An assumption that won't work is assuming that someone else will respond exactly as you want them to. There's a whole other seminar series in the spring of next year that I do call Breaking the Script. It's the essence of what we do in mentor coaching, is to help our client break the script and to create new scripts. So without being consciously aware, you can focus on something you don't want and bring it about. Remember, our focus, the energy field of our brain follows our focus. So this is something that becomes important to look at, what exactly are we focusing on, and is it exactly what we want? Does it fit with needs and ideals? This paradox can occur in any aspect of life. What you don't want, you ironically make happen. Focusing on not making mistakes creates mistakes. Focusing on not being late creates lateness. Focusing on not wanting to be financially insolvent creates scarcity. Focusing on not smoking makes you want to smoke. Remember, I mentioned early on the shortest example of this is my wife and I did the BMW racing school for 3 days, taught by pro drivers. The first thing with the first exercise we did of going driving at high speed around slippery corners, the first admonition, the first instruction was, don't focus on what you want to avoid because you'll hit it every time. Focus on where you want to go. Same in coaching. Focus on where you want to go, because focusing on what you want to avoid is a focus. Your mind is an energy field and responds to focus. Whether the focus is negative or positive, the response is the focus. Your mind precisely and effectively creates what you focus on. Brain research shows that focusing on problems or negative behavior reinforces those problems and behaviors. Additionally, the harder you push people to change, the harder they're going to push back. The best mentor coaching strategies focus on the present and on possibilities and solutions rather than problems. This expedites the development of new neural pathways in the brain and new thinking patterns. The most important principle is to focus on what you do want rather than what you don't want. Second, become consciously aware so that you can direct this power of focus to the specific outcomes you want. And there are different ways to do this. One is a kind of a goofy exercise to look at things that you focus on that you don't want. So make a list of all the to-don't list and recognize that as soon as possible to redirect, to reframe and refocus on what you do want. Be very specific about what you do want. Make a list, a to-do list, and be certain that what you want to do is not just what you don't want in disguise. You know, an example, I want a relationship in which I'm treated well and regarded positively. Well, the expectation is of negativity avoided, not being treated well, having to reverse it, saying, I want a reliable car. That focuses on the potential breakdown and repair. So to avoid something begins a focus. Don't focus on what you want to avoid. Take it from the BMW Pro. Work on these lists every time that you notice that you have a response and a choice and feel the challenge. These two lists can crystallize some beliefs and assumptions that you may not be fully consciously aware of. Each time you think about an outcome you don't want, stop and consciously change your thinking to focus on precisely what you do want. Recognize it as an error message from your brain. Reframe to what you do want, the positive, the challenge, and refocus on the next step to do that. Now, these changes are really a hard work miracle. Practice and persistence of this is paramount. Every time you recognize a negative focus and practice those three basic steps of self-directed neuroplasticity, it will rewire your brain. A bit time. So let's look for a moment at a kind of a different level here. Neuroscience offers us insights about the relationship of motivation and performance incentives. This can have relevance for how you and your clients determine goals and specifically what those goals are. Always determined by the client, but these are just some thoughts. When brain activity is monitored during performance, the nucleus accumbens, the pleasure center, lights up whenever we anticipate something. When a financial incentive, for example, presents a strong allure, reason as well as motivation can be swayed and hijacked by the pleasure center. In fact, it's the anticipation of doing something that creates dopamine. It's the anticipation of spending, the anticipation of taking a drug or doing an action that creates a hit of dopamine. And this is the paradox, that often when whatever it is done, there's a paradoxical reaction, because what we thought would bring the reward isn't really what brought the, it's the anticipation that brought the reward. The actual doing it results in a shutting down of that system, so it can be read as disappointment or something that isn't nearly as exciting as you thought it would be. The reward resembles the response to cocaine, meaning it has an addictive potential. The anticipation of pleasure from some reward triggers the pleasure center to release dopamine. So neuroscientists have found another brain paradox. I presented this following information not too long ago at a keynote to 600 members of a consortium of nonprofit foundations. I saw a lot of raised eyebrows and open mouths. This paradox is one that's inversely related to the pleasure center. That part of the brain that mediates social interactions, how we perceive and relate to others, is the posterior superior temporal sulcus. Not important to remember, but this part of the brain is the altruism center, the center that lights up when we help others and form bonds. Now, here's the paradox. The pleasure center and the altruism center compete with one another. When one's in control, it shuts down the other, not both at the same time. When someone does something like nonprofit charity work for altruistic reasons, the altruism center is firing. Then, if money's offered, the altruism center shuts down and the pleasure center lights up. So here's a couple of practical examples. One large blood center, low on supplies for transfusions, decided to offer people money to donate blood. Offering to pay decreased the number of donors by just over half. They were baffled. What they found that reversed that effect? Having the donors contribute the money to charity. Here's another example. Daycare centers in Israel began fining parents for late pickups. And when that happened, the number of tardy parents more than doubled. They were baffled. Why? The parents no longer felt ethically obligated to not inconvenience the teachers because they then felt that they were paying the teachers for their lateness. Time had become a commodity. Studies repeatedly show that a financial reward will undermine altruistic motivation. When the pleasure center hijacks the altruism center, motivation changes dramatically to that of self-interest. So here's a final illustration. Roadblocks to success. Darren Brown did an experiment in the UK in London on Regent Street, which has a lot of pedestrian traffic. Darren placed his wallet with money clearly sticking out on the sidewalk. He then drew a circle with yellow chalk around the wallet, sort of like the crime scenes on TV. Then he walked away, leaving the wallet and the money showing just lying there. Hundreds of people walked past this wallet. Most people saw it, looked at it. Many stopped. Not one single person picked it up. The yellow chalk circle seemed to be a barrier that people were reluctant to cross. 100% of them did not cross it. So the yellow chalk circle, the assumption that limited people from simply picking up the wallet, was the barrier. A question. What is your yellow chalk circle? A hint? It may be any assumption that limits you. So here's a summary of listening and interacting as mentor coaches. First, put your ego in a blind trust. In other words, don't take it personally. Know that the client is doing the job description that is needed by showing you exactly what it's like to be that person. A simple example. I had a referral not too long ago from a corporate group. One of their inner circle, their board members, their directors, was annoying everyone in the orbit of that person. And they had collectively decided to let that person go. And finally, one person said, well, you know, let's give Kruger a shot at this. Let's see what can happen. So referred the person to me. I first asked, does he want to be here? And everything we talk about is absolutely privileged and confidential, as I would anyway. And as we began, guess what? He began to annoy me. So he was doing his job. He was showing me exactly what it's like to be him and what created that experience with other people. That 90 to 95% of our operating system that's not conscious, he was doing the very best job he could to show me that, not consciously, but he did, so that we could together, collaboratively, and with a working alliance, decide how to understand that and how to revise that over time. So remember not to take it personally. A client will always show you exactly what they're dealing with. Every algorithm that determines that client's feeling, thinking, behaving, interaction, attachment patterns will be repeated with you, usually while you're talking about other stuff. This is what you develop a working alliance and a collaboration with someone so you can look at it together and to see how, from their point of reference, they want to revise their own story. To continue the summary of listening, listen to the language, whether it's active or passive. This will tell you about someone of how they regard their own authority. For example, well, my anxiety took over. My doubt stopped me. They have become a passive participant of what they're creating. They are the author of that feeling or that experience, and then they see themselves as the victim of it. Grist for the mill for mentor coaching. Listen to the point of reference, whether internal or external. Think about if you watched an interview with someone, usually someone always responds in first person. They'll say, I. At some point, if there's something that's a little bit uncomfortable, or something they want to disavow or have some doubt about, they will shift into second person to refer to themselves instead of I or we, to say you. So what they've done is to create a little bit of distance of something that they may not be quite comfortable about, but not even be aware of making that shift. Listen to the source of authority, whether it's self or other, related exactly. Listen for the initiation of action, whether proactive or reactive. Listen for how centered the client is in their own experience. Listen especially for the state of mind of the speaker and whether the state of mind is regulated and fits the task. So, here are some elements of mentor coaching successful changes. The first requirement is claiming ownership of the story, followed by recognition in order to understand, assess, and change. Peter Drucker said, the most pressing challenge is to teach people how to learn. So let's review some important elements in mentor coaching for successful change. Concentrate on new behaviors rather than problems in order to create new brain pathways. Identifying a problem won't solve it. Don't focus on where you don't want to go. Co-create new ways of thinking to stimulate new brain circuits. An eye on the prize that can begin to lay new mental maps. Especially regulate a state of mind and manage emotions to have access to all of the information, data, and experience in all states of mind. To be a true search engine, if there's an altered state, it will skew that and boot up a particular software program that will not have access to perhaps other necessary components. Facilitate insight rather than give advice. People can usually discriminate between inquiries that prompt insight and attempts at persuasion, or camouflaging a suggestion in the form of a question. Focus on successes rather than obstacles or non-performance. The power is in the focus. Emphasize positive adaptive behavior and progress. Discourage attention to negative behavior. Refocus, redirect. Facilitate new behaviors, guide the development and actualization of new mental maps. Collaboratively conceptualize the mental map, the internal model of the client, in order to facilitate a new level of mastery. In the event of diversion to an old feeling or behavior, redirect ideas and energy to the present, the next step. Remember, the power is in the focus, and that permanent change arises from consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the brain. This is one of the versions of this is the curse of knowledge, that we have knowledge, that we know some things, and that we assume the client will know what we know and begin communication at that level, but that is perhaps the beginning of a failed empathy, to not appreciate how the client sees and experiences things. The power is in the focus. Permanent change arises from the consistency of that focus. Knowledge conveyed passively is inert. Knowledge generated through insight changes the mind and brain. And finally, we want to consider conceptualizing the meta map with the client in order to master and internalize the process, to focus on the story the client's creating and help the client develop their own story with their point of reference, so that new experiences, new ways of thinking are incorporated into the client's evolving story. So here's, as we close, here are a couple of my predictions that you asked. Going forward, we will develop new ways of recognizing and understanding synchronicities, individual and collective energy fields, and a number of phenomena which are part of our experience and universe. Then in the tomorrows ahead, we will evolve concepts and descriptive systems. Way more than we have now. We'll develop words and a language, a nomenclature for things we only sense right now. For example, individual and collective energy field. And this stems from Einstein's unified field theory of human energy. So in this exchange, in these seminars, I believe if you've hung with me, and I know you have, and I appreciate the questions and the comments and kind words you sent on, you've embraced your growth mindset to engage in new and different ways of thinking. And here's a quote from Harry Houdini, the magician, who reminded us, just because something's unexplained doesn't mean it's supernatural. And to paraphrase Garrison Keillor, be happy, be well, go out and do good work. So it's been my pleasure and my privilege to discuss these notions with you in these four seminars. I hope we'll have additional opportunity to collaborate. So I'm going to put us on discussion mode. And if you'll manage the background noise, I welcome thoughts, questions, comments, or just clarifications. What you got?
Hey, this is Bill.
Hey, Bill. Welcome. Hey.
Yeah. First of all, I want to thank you very much. It's been very rich, enriching. A lot of great material.
That means a lot coming from you, my man.
Well, no, it's, you know, a growth mindset. I'm always learning, and I appreciate a lot of new things, and also the validation of back to basics from so much of this in our coaching opportunities. And one of the things I thought you might want to elaborate just a little bit on, I think, and I may have mistaken, but I think somewhere along the line, we talked about the fact that people may have a natural negative bias. Is that correct, or tell me a little more about that?
Okay, whenever we talk about that, I didn't use that term, but that's a good place to start, because I think what you're describing is a way that we're automatically hardwired to react if we respond by looking at what can be wrong, kind of like the focus, like the negative thought loop or repetitive focus on problems. We are inclined, let's say, an example of that would be you have a bunch of buddies over, you're on the patio, you're having a glass of wine. What happens within the first few minutes of that discussion? Most likely, and your buddies are not any different than mine, most likely people are going to be animated and beginning to talk about the problems, the challenges they've had. We automatically go to problems. Our clients will too, because that is, in its own way, even though it's uncomfortable, it's secure. It's hardwired. We know the pathway. This is why, as we discussed just briefly, this is how people get stuck in therapy, because they pursue problems even to hopefully resolve or create different challenges, opportunities, ways of doing. But each time you engage a problem, it etches it further in the brain. It's an already existing pathway. So it brings closure, and relatively, it's easier. Now, there's a ceiling, there's a limit. It may be frustrating, but that's our brain's inclination to repeat what we know. Now, on the other hand, taking one step into the new, the different, the unknown, creates a bit of trepidation, a bit of uncertainty. And that's where we are with our clients. And when we appreciate that, we can help them take that step. Now, this is something that I think every one of you will be dealing with in coaching, which is why I want to mention kind of an extreme example to illustrate it here. With every one of your clients, you'll be dealing with this juncture of looking at something that's new, that's different, of dealing with their success with something, and that may bring experiences that they have never had before. So this is a decision process that we need to appreciate and look at things, especially that have been unprecedented. Look at the last blog that I posted on my website under blogs called The Vampire Problem. I'm going to not take away the expense and the suspense and get you to look at it, but each time we do something new and different or novel, there's a bit of trepidation. And especially when things are new and unprecedented, think about the kinds of unprecedented experiences your clients will have. Having a baby for the first time. A kind of unprecedented success that will bring fame, wealth, power, influence. The more extreme, the more difficult, the more challenging, and the more they will need you as a mentor coach to help them first regulate state of mind and manage emotion to deal with things with the full contingency of all that they know and can do logically, consciously, and collaboratively, and to deal with things that they don't have a model for, that they can't rely on a past experience to inform them because it's new and categorically different. Now, paradoxically, and I know I'm going a couple of minutes over and ask you to indulge me here, paradoxically, intuition, which is also based on simulation in a totally different way of existing models and experiences, intuition can mislead because that's also based on old models and old software. So this is a juncture where we, I believe, will be essentially useful for our clients. This is not in any way anything anybody touches in counseling, therapy, anything. This is what we uniquely do as coaches, is to help a client now and next develop a new story step by step. So, Bill, does that kind of address?
It does, and it's the coaching challenge to help the client, in your words, to help them really try to move problems into possibilities.
Yes.
And that's our job. And if we can get that done, we've done a good job. Well,
it's a creative and invigorating challenge. Thank you all very much. If there are any questions or comments that you want to, you have my email address, fire them off and I'll promise to respond to you. Thank you so much for all of your engagement and responses throughout. I appreciate it. And I welcome any questions or follow-up. So thanks very, very much. See you guys.
Thank you. Thank you.